Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, ongoing series of conversations about the cultures of consciousness. One conversation I had recently was with a good skeptical friend of mine, and he was making the argument that if there was really much substance in the kinds of paranormal, parapsychological, occult, magical worlds that continue to obsess moderns, despite the apparent dominance of science and rationality, his argument was like, look, we would have seen this stuff. We would have seen the military use it. We would have seen governments use it against their own people or against enemies. And there's some, you know, really good, solid information there. It's like if you look at the history of, let's say, remote viewing and the way in which the defense industry supported this parapsychological research. You know, on the one hand, it seems to acknowledge that something was there, and there, if you go into the details, you see some sort of evidence or apparent evidence that at least some individuals have this very powerful, peculiar, incomprehensible, magical ability to see into distant spaces, but you don't really see it kind of play out inside the actual historical field. So that was his argument. And to that I responded that I think something subtler has happened or has been happening, continues to happen, which is that the elements of the magical, paranormal, parapsychological, weird, irrational world that actually do have some sort of play in what we would think of as real history, that those simply become incorporated into business as usual, while the things that are more extreme remain on the outside, in the paranormal, in the irrational. Not that those things are exactly equivalent, but the idea being that we have already appropriated those elements of magic, of occultism, of mystery traditions that have real historical force. So I thought that was kind of a clever argument. But it really wasn't my own argument. It was stuff that I had read about in my own research into these matters and talked a little bit about in Technosis, but it jumped into my mind more forcefully recently when I read a paper by another old friend and interlocutor of mine, William Mazzarella, who's a professor of anthropology and social sciences at the University of Chicago, and he posted a wonderful paper on academia.edu, which, as you know, I sometimes hawk on this show as a wonderful place for those of us on the outside of the academic mill to dip our toes into some pretty interesting contemporary research, and he wrote a piece called The Mana of Mass Publicity, Prelude to an Anthropology Lost and Found. And in that, he quotes Ion Cugliano, who's a great historian of esotericism in the Hermetic tradition in the West, who kind of addresses the same idea. Cugliano writes, "We would tend to say that the actual magician and the prophet have now vanished. More probably, however, they have simply been camouflaged in sober and legal guises. Nowadays, the magician busies himself with public relations, propaganda, market research, sociological surveys, publicity information, counterinformation, misinformation, censorship, espionage, and even cryptography, a science which in the 16th century was a branch of magic." Now, there's a lot of things to do with this concept, but one of the things that William does in his paper, and which has always intrigued me, continues to be a fascination of mine, is not so much how we can recognize the way that things we do today are based on, pre-modern ideas about magic or action at a distance. What's more interesting is what happens when we go back into those sources, when we try to understand those ideas that in many ways we pushed outside of the scientific rationality game, and see what they have to say of where we are now. And what William does in this great essay is to talk about the 19th century, very popular 19th century anthropological idea of mana, or mana, I'm not even sure how you pronounce it, why that idea rose, why it fell, why does it live on, this idea of some kind of abstract power that's in objects but outside of objects, and how returning to this idea with a new perspective can help illuminate contemporary situations. And this is particularly key to William's work because though he's an anthropologist, he has not done his field work in the usual fringes of modernity. Instead, he's done it at the very heart of modernity by looking at advertising, in particular in contemporary India, and that led to his first book, Shoveling Smoke, Advertising and Globalization in Contemporary India. So it's a very interesting approach. Using anthropological tools to study, essentially, ourselves. All right, with no further ado, William, thanks for joining us in Expanding Mind.
Yeah, thanks, Eric, for having me.
Yeah, great. So, you know, I'd just like to hear a little bit, since it's sort of unusual to meet an anthropologist who studies advertisers and marketers, I'd just like to hear a little bit about that. I know that was sort of your main field work back in the day, but it continues to inform all of your work. Talk a little bit about like what it was that led to that being the place that you wanted to do field work. What is it like to study in a way us, even though it was a different us in India? It gets complicated because it's, of course, they have their own histories and their own approaches to these matters, but it's also something that, you know, that lies at the heart of the developed modern world. So, yeah. So what does it mean to be an anthropologist of modernity in that way?
Sure. Well, that in itself is not such a new thing. Anthropologists have been studying industrial settings and even the mass media for a long time. For instance, Hortense Powdermaker wrote a book about Hollywood, an anthropological study of Hollywood, back in the 1940s. But what I would say is that, you know, one thing that happened in the 1980s, really in anthropology and I think in the social sciences and humanities, was a kind of crisis of confidence in the old models, you know, that we would go out and study small-scale societies, what used to be known 100 years ago as primitive societies. And there was a kind of turning towards problems of globalization, problems of mass media, problems of science, and how those things could be approached in an anthropological way. So for me, picking up on the theme of advertising was really a way of thinking about, okay, now that it's no longer possible just to think of like culture in that old sort of innocent way that anthropologists supposedly thought about it before, now that we kind of have to start thinking about the ways in which culture is something that people are actually deliberately producing, sometimes they're producing it as political propaganda, sometimes they're producing it as, you know, advertising, sometimes they're producing it as, you know, nationalism or whatever it may be. What would be like a good site to get at that kind of production? And it seemed to me that advertising was one of those institutions that was at once profoundly global and profoundly local. Like one of the things about the advertising business is that it always has to negotiate between global capital, global brands on the one hand, and you know, local cultural preferences on the other. So you get into these problems of what does it mean to translate, say, a global brand for a local market, or conversely, what does it mean to globalize a local brand? So that was really my way into advertising as an object. It seemed to me like it was, on the one hand, a way of thinking about the relationship between the global and the local in a fresh way, and on the other hand, a way of thinking about the relationship between culture and capitalism in a new way.
Well, it's also interesting because, you know, as you mentioned in your article, and I'm sure you'll probably develop more in the book length version of this project, is the fact that anthropology has also been absorbed into advertising to many degrees, even to the point that people, you know, coming out with PhDs in anthropology wind up working in marketing, and that's been going on for a long time. That's not your approach. But it is really interesting just to reflect on how important anthropology is to this sort of central force of culture and meaning in the contemporary world.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think actually one of the things that I've been kind of preoccupied with in the work that I'm doing now, including with the MANA project, is to think about some of the ways in which this kind of appropriation of anthropology by governments and by corporations, and especially the appropriation of the culture concept, may not be doing us any favors in terms of, kind of anthropological understanding. I think we often end up with a pretty stereotyped conceptions of what culture may be when it gets harnessed to projects like marketing or, multicultural politics or something like that. So that's been a real issue for me. And it kind of played out also in a way when I was doing the field work for my advertising project back in the 90s in Bombay in India, where I think the people I was working with, the advertising agency where I was doing field work every day, I used to go in and sit in on meetings and, meet with clients along with the agency and so forth. One of the things that happened was that I realized that some of the people in the advertising agency kind of presumed that they knew what an anthropologist would be doing in an advertising agency. And their perception of what that was basically that an anthropologist would bring a kind of cultural expertise to bear on the marketing process, right? That the anthropologist would be in some sense attached to this kind of market research process that they were engaged in and clarifying, what is the Indian consumer? What are the cultural preferences of Indian consumers and things like that? Whereas what I was trying to do was actually something quite different. And I think to them or to some of them, actually it turned out to be kind of disturbing, which was to kind of not study the Indian consumer, but to study the advertising professionals themselves. So, they kind of felt the spotlight turning on them. And, some of them were comfortable with that and some of them were not.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It does reflect on something that you talk about in your paper as well. And I think it has reached a bit of a crisis point, though people don't necessarily acknowledge it, is that it may be the case that the term culture and the associations we have it in that term are kind of past their due date, that they're as much an obstruction now as a help. I mean, I notice in my own thinking how often I fall back onto a certain kind of uncritical notion of culture as a way to explain what's happening in this little pocket of cultural production. There, I just use it. It's so easy to fall on it, and yet there's something about it that's shifted, that's become used, that's become manipulated in ways that the sort of innocence of the term still kind of disguises in a way, as if culture is something that human beings just kind of naturally develop around enthusiasms, lifestyles, practices. But so much of what we think of as culture now is engineered, is produced for its own cultural reasons. And so it becomes like a term that's not really clear. Is it useful? Does it get in the way? What do we replace it with? I'm sure these are things that you've been thinking about.
Yeah, for sure. And in fact, part of the larger project of the MANA thing that I've been working on and that you kindly referenced right now, the larger project is a book that's actually called The MANA of Mass Society that should be out next year from University of Chicago Press. Part of the project there is to kind of develop alternative ways of thinking about what we anthropologists, and not just anthropologists, but increasingly people in the general sort of public space have thought of as culture. So the concept that I introduce as a kind of alternative to that, and I think I mentioned it in that paper that you referenced as well, is mimetic archive. And we don't have to go into too much detail about that right now, but basically the reason why the MANA concept was sort of interesting to me, or one of the reasons why it was interesting to me, is that it has this kind of doubleness to it. So on the one hand, MANA appears as a kind of force that gives a particular social order or a particular cultural order a kind of gravity, the kind of thing that makes you respect the law, that makes you respect a particular set of moral norms or something like that. And yet at the same time, MANA has this kind of quality of always leaking out beyond the boundaries of any particular order that would kind of seek to use it, so that it's kind of both this power for stability and a kind of constant principle of instability as well. And I thought that was one of the things that made it really, really powerful as a kind of concept to think with, and in a way maybe makes it kind of symptomatic of a kind of series of problems that we've been grappling with, in sort of thinking about public life and thinking about collective life for many, many years.
Well, let's put some more flesh on the bones of the concept and talk a little bit about this moment in the 19th century when anthropology is just developing sort of in the shadow of colonialism, trying to grapple with what is the nature of these others that are being incorporated into an increasingly global order. Let's say whether or not that people are reading their texts or looking at their myths or eventually sending people out to go and study and live with the people and report about it. There's this sort of encounter with folks in Polynesia, and this concept of mana, which becomes a sort of global term that gets applied to lots of different cultures, to Native American cultures, to cultures all over the world. So it becomes a kind of plastic idea. But what are the ways in which the term was meaningful for the people who first used it? Like, how is it first sort of seen by anthropologists and by people studying non-Western folks?
Well, that's a great question, because part, I think, of what fascinated the early scholars of the concept in the late 19th century was that the concept was so enigmatic. Like, it seemed so hard to really pin down. As you mentioned, it was a concept that came from the area of the Pacific that we now call Melanesia and Polynesia. And in those, even across several of the societies in that area, it seemed to have somewhat different meanings. So, for instance, in some cases, mana seemed like something that referred to a kind of impersonal or abstract supernatural force, or a kind of principle of efficacy, a kind of force that would make things happen. In some cases, it seemed more like something that might be embodied in individuals, like, say, powerful chiefs or something like that, in the way that we would now, say, talk about the charisma of a leader or something like that, so that you could say, in the latter case, you know, that so-and-so person has a lot of mana, in the sense that they seem to exude a kind of power or efficacy or authority of a particular kind, of a particular heightened kind. So there were all these debates about, you know, was mana an impersonal concept? Was it a personal thing? Was it even a thing at all? Was it really grammatically something that Pacific Islanders used as a verb, a noun, an adjective? All those different kinds of usages seem to crop up at different moments. And so part of the fascination of this concept was that it was just so kind of slippery and seemed to refer to so many different things. Now, the other thing that was happening at the same time, and what really drew me into thinking about this, was that at the same time, so we're talking basically the late 19th century and the very, very early 20th century, at that same time, anthropologists were talking about and discovering this idea of mana, in the Pacific, and thinking about its relationship to other kind of cognate terms in other parts of the world. In North America, Native American societies, etc. But at the same time as that was going on within anthropology, there was this obsessive concern among sociologists and social psychologists and cultural theorists in the Euro-American industrialized world with the energies of crowds and mobs, right? So this is the moment where you have, in the industrial West, you have a kind of movement toward mass suffrage. You have really intensifying industrialization at the same time as kind of the second wave of colonial expansion in the late 19th century, and particularly what was known as the scramble for Africa. So I became really interested in this question of, you know, this implicit comparison that was going on between the mana of so-called primitive ritual and the mana of urban industrial crowds, and particularly the question of how those crowds seem to be ambiguously both crowds and publics. So this is also the time in the Euro-American West where what we now think of as our kind of systems of mass media, advertising, publicity, etc., were moving into place. So there was something here in this resonance between the so-called primitive world and the so-called civilized world, which had a kind of common focus on this problem of a kind of enigmatic energy that seemed to be animating society in ways that was both about maintaining order in the sense of kind of the authority of moral systems. And on the other hand, this kind of panic about sort of savagery, really, to use the old prejudicial term, right? Whether it was the savagery of those who were supposed to be primitive, in small-scale societies around the world, or whether it was the sort of the savagery of, rioting crowds, possibly, revolutionary crowds. So there was something there that was going on at that time, what I call, in this project, I call it the Mana moment, like roughly this period between 1870 and 1920, when there's a kind of real effort to think about, on the one hand, an effort to think about this correspondence between kind of the industrial mass-mediated world and the so-called primitive world, but on the other hand, like a constant disavowal of that relationship as well. So that's something that I'm really interested in, is this sort of ambiguous movement back and forth between saying, we're just the same as they are, and on the other hand, in the very next breath, saying, no, we're completely different than they are. And, and somehow mana becomes like the symptom or the mark of that ambivalence.
Another thing that's really interesting about that is that in a previous moment in anthropology, let's say, the discovery of this connection between the mana concept as it is used in anthropology to talk about non-Western peoples and the correspondence between that and these developments in the West, the rise of mass publicity, the new notion of crowds whose desire can be organized through media or through propaganda, that connection would be then used to discount the whole thing. You'd say, well, what the anthropologists were actually doing, were trying to come up with these vague concepts that talked about their own period. It really doesn't tell us anything about the people in question, so let's just get rid of that concept. Let's stop talking about mana. And in fact, you talk about how a later generation of anthropologists more or less make this move. They say this is bad anthropology. It's too generalized. Let's discount these ideas. But you come at sort of a different moment, not just this kind of self-reflective deconstruction of these general ideas within anthropology, but you're also saying, hey, there may be something still very powerful in thinking about these concepts with all of their generality and ambivalence as a way to thinking about what's happening now. On a real level, on the level of every day where you and I participate, we have desires, we don't know whether we're creating them or we're being advertised to, we feel we're parts of these mass organ, bodies of people, and yet we're still individuals, and all this. And it's, things are happening so much now with technology, et cetera, we can, talk endlessly about the peculiarities of our moment in which something that's not particularly rational seems to be very generalized and very powerful in terms of shaping reality, shaping desire, et cetera, et cetera. And you seem to be saying, like, look, there are reasons for us to still think about these concepts. But not just mana, but also magic and other kinds of irrational concepts that have come up in social history as a way of understanding what's really going on with our contemporary moment. So that's an interesting turn. It's sort of beyond just the kind of critical historical contextualization move to say, actually, there's something really here that we can play with and learn from.
Yeah, that's right. So as you mentioned, what ended up happening in anthropology was basically a kind of backlash against this kind of speculative mana talk and a move to sort of say, well, really what anthropology should be doing is to kind of specify just how people in specific, Pacific Island societies use this term, like what is the grammar of how they use it, like what does it mean for them? And so this whole kind of comparative speculative moment that had sort of begun to open up this question of the relationship between the Western and the non-Western, or the small-scale society and the mass-mediated society, sort of fell by the wayside. And one of the outcomes of that settlement, in a way, which is what I call it, one of the outcomes of that kind of agreement was that we also ended up maybe not asking the questions that you were just pointing to, right? Which is the ways in which, maybe there is something kind of magical in the way that we think about things like mass publicity, in the ways that we kind of engage with things like publicity, whether, our engagement is one of thinking, marketing is going to solve all our problems. That's kind of a magical way of thinking. Or whether it's the idea that we think that, you know, we're all being controlled by some kind of, you know, conspiratorial cabal, you know, in some bunker underneath Nevada somewhere, you know, which is pulling the levers of, you know, what goes on in the internet or, you know, on television or whatever. So, you know, the whole way in which we think about the space of mass publicity and what goes on with things like political propaganda and advertising is full of these kinds of, you know, magical modes of thinking. And so part of what interests me in all this is, you know, this question of how do we begin to unpack, to understand, you know, our kind of magical investments in the space of mass publicity.
Yeah, let's go into that more in terms of thinking about mass publicity, thinking about advertising. What do you think, since you've been working on this in this field for so long now, what do you think are some of the sort of initial mistakes that people make when they think about this, when they approach the problem of how do we really think about how these things work in our lives, how they control us, how they don't control us, how we participate in these processes? And I mean, it seems to me we're all aware of it. We all have different stories about how we relate to mass publicity, let's say, or propaganda. And I think that there's probably some better and some worse ways of approaching the matter. I mean, I know that I have a story in my head about how somehow I developed the capacity to not really pay attention to advertising and celebrity stuff very much, because I find that I often don't know about things that a lot of other people know about, even though I read the papers and I keep up with the internet. And I also know that this is partly a myth that I tell myself because I want to feel like I'm somehow outside of the circuits of desire that are, you know, kind of co-producing reality through technology, through media, through advertising, through commodification, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm aware of even my own myths about how I relate to this sphere. So when we come to really think about it, let's think about it, and let's even think about how there is a magical or maybe a magical dimension to it, or a reason to think about it in terms of magical or mana. What are some of the, you think, kind of errors or clarifications that are important to make in order to really grapple with the issue?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and one that I spend a lot of time trying to think through. You know, I think there's a pretty simple thing that we can start out with, which is that, you know, in some puzzling way, the debate around mass publicity and what our relationship as spectators or consumers or whatever is to mass publicity has kind of been stuck in this rut for decades and decades. And that rut, if we want to just kind of simplify it a little bit, would be to say that there are basically two arguments that are made, and they're kind of like the inverse of each other. So the first argument is basically the one that you get from, you know, the marketing business or the propagandists themselves, which is to say, you know, we are not fabricating needs, we are not creating false needs, we are simply catering to, you know, what consumers or citizens already want, right? So this idea that, you know, mass publicity is a kind of provisioning mechanism that basically finds out what people want and then sort of gives them what they want, right? So that's the one side of the argument. The other side of the argument is, of course, the kind of manipulation thesis, right? The idea that, you know, basically what mass publicity is trying to do is trying to, in various ways, kind of con us or brainwash us or manipulate us into something, and that our task as kind of critical members of society has to be constantly kind of vigilant against those kind of attempts to seduce us into some kind of agenda that we, you know, are all too easily fall prey to. So I think that, you know, the first thing to do is to kind of say, okay, that's not a very useful argument, because neither of those two really gets at kind of the core of what's going on. The argument that I try to develop in this project is around an idea which I borrow from the German philosopher Peter Sloterdijk, but it's an idea that he himself develops on the basis of sort of thinking about long histories of, you know, esoteric thought and thought about communication and resonance. And the concept that he develops is a concept that he calls constitutive resonance. And the idea there is that whether you're talking about interpersonal relations or whether you're talking about, you know, mass mediated relationships, whether you're talking about, you know, an intimate relationship that you might have with a friend or a lover or a colleague or whatever, or you're talking about some kind of encounter that you have with an advertisement or a movie or a political leader or something like that, that what happens when that relationship feels live or vital or feels like something is going on there of some value is a kind of activation of potentials that are in both parties, right? So it's the encounter between the two that activates a kind of resonance that then, as it were, allows each party to the relationship to become, in a sense, what it always was potentially, but not yet actually. So it's a kind of idea of the social field being made up of potentialities that are actualized through encounters, right? And so I find that a much more helpful way of thinking about what happens in the space of mass publicity, as well as in the space of just interpersonal relationships, than either this thing of like, you know, that, you know, we're just sort of being catered to what we already want, which makes it seem as if we are always already like the people that we end up being in the end, or this idea that we're constantly being kind of brainwashed or manipulated. In fact, the problem with both those positions, this is kind of my argument in the larger project, is that both of those rest on a kind of fixation that we have on the idea that we as individuals are autonomous and kind of self-supporting, what would be the word? What would be a good expression for that? Autonomous, basically, right? That we make our own choices freely, that we are who we are, and we go into the world and make choices on the basis of that sort of self-sufficient identity. And I think that idea is at the basis both of this kind of marketing ideology, right? That sort of people are who they are, they have preferences, they have desires. The purpose of marketing or propaganda is to give them what they want, to fulfill their desires. And that idea of the autonomous individual is also at the basis of this kind of paranoid scenario that we're being kind of manipulated, because then what it means to, as it were, be to resist that is to kind of realize your autonomy as a sort of self-determining individual. So I'm more interested in opening up this question of how we can think about our relationship to our environment, whether it's an environment of mass-mediated messages or it's an environment of other people or it's an environment of political ideologies or movements or whatever. I'm more interested in thinking about opening up that space as a space of resonances, as a space of affinities. And, you know, of course, resonances are not always pleasant resonances, right? Just because you resonate with something doesn't mean that you like it or that you love it or that you desire it or that you want it. It could also mean that you resonate with it in such a way that it becomes very clear to you that it's exactly not what you want, that it's like the thing that you define yourself by opposing. Or it might even be a kind of attachment to a notion of indifference, right? Which is kind of what you started out with, right? Your own story, right? Which is that you imagine that your relationship to mass publicity is one of kind of having tuned out or of being kind of largely indifferent. That's also a way of living with mass publicity. And of course, you know, however we live with it, unless we're entirely isolated in some way, we do absorb its kind of ambient vibrations one way or the other.
Absolutely. And I want to stay a little bit with this term, resonance, this concept of resonance, because it's been something in my life, not just my intellectual life, but also in terms of how I live my life, the ethics of my life. That term has taken on increased importance. And what's interesting is just as someone who's been following New Age thought and alternative hermetic thought for a long time, is that it's a very important term, and it has always been an important term in those worlds. I mean, I think the first place you found a widespread use of the term resonance to mean something other than the physical phenomena of resonance, of resonating circuits or resonating rooms or whatever, outside of acoustics and physics. It was in the New Age. You know, they would talk about the resonant frequency. They would talk about resonating with different crystals or different places. And it always struck me what a fascinating term, because on the one hand, it is a term drawn from physics. And yet it also seems to describe so well a kind of feeling we have emotionally, psychologically, intellectually when we encounter something that really moves us, that really seems to draw something very familiar and yet brings it into, as you describe it, an event, an encounter. When I was writing my dissertation, I kind of went deeper into the term as a way of talking about certain things that happen in altered states and psychedelic phenomenology, and the ways in which resonance really is a very productive way of understanding in a way the kind of emotional psychic side of our modern lives, where we tend to put so much emphasis on the kind of rational decision-making sides of our modern lives, where there's sort of more, where the metaphors of resonance seem a little bit weird and dreamlike and kind of messy because the causality is never clear. The causality is never really clear. Who's starting the resonance? It doesn't really work that way. I mean, it does ultimately, but the part of the effect of resonance is that once it's happening, it's not really clear, or it matters less who started the event. It's something that emerges between different people, different forces, different technologies. And then it also has this technological development. That's one thing that's in your paper that we haven't talked about, is how there's a kind of an electromagnetism to this whole conversation too, that the idea of mana was infused with electrical ideas, as you talk about in the paper, and that's also part of what's making this new space of mass publicity of the modern crowd is mediated through electromagnetism to some degree. And that's partly where we get our metaphor, or our modern metaphor of resonance, is how electrical circuits operate. That's how radios work. That's how a lot of the technologies we use, they're exploiting resonance in a literal scientific way. So it's a very, very rich concept. In some ways, it seems kind of a no-brainer, and yet, as a theoretical idea, it's fresh, and there's something there that I think that has real implications that, in some ways, people like yourselves are just getting to. It seems like something worth really kind of putting forward in a way to understand things that we've thought about in different ways up till now.
Yeah, I think that's. Absolutely right. And I think the problem there, right, the way that, as you say, it seems like it's such an obvious idea. So why don't we think that way more? Like, why is that not the way we think about these things, normally? And it seems like I was saying a little while ago that part of the obstacle there has to do with our attachment to the notion that we are these kind of bounded self-regulating, kind of self-enclosed entities that kind of go into the world and, affect the world or don't affect the world, or get what we want or don't get what we want. And that way of thinking of ourselves as these kind of bounded subjects acting in the world in a way militates against imagining ourselves as fundamentally and constitutively and at the very root creatures of resonance. You mentioned Ioan Culiano earlier. And in fact, Sloterdijk, who I just mentioned and who uses this term constitutive resonance, cites Culiano in that argument. And that's what put me onto Culiano. And then, I started thinking about this whole correspondence that you're also talking about a long tradition of kind of esoteric thought. And on the other hand, this field of kind of modern mass publicity. And of course, Culiano, as you mentioned, made that connection without really taking it anywhere. Like he says in his book on Renaissance magic that, as you read out that quotation, and basically what he's saying is that, if we're going to be looking for the magician in modern society nowadays, we should be looking in places like advertising or propaganda or, counterintelligence or censorship or things like that. And it's true that, a very useful way of thinking about something like marketing or thinking about something like, political campaigns is on the model of, the magus, the one who knows the esoteric correspondences between people and people and people and things in the world, right? The one who knows how to activate those resonances such that people will be bound to certain kinds of relationships and certain kinds of desires. Now, of course, when it comes to mass publicity, stuff like advertising and propaganda and so forth, it's easy to start thinking about that in a very kind of paranoid sort of way. Like, is there some magician pulling the strings? Is there some, you know, agency behind the scenes that is kind of manipulating us through some kind of exquisitely, you know, fine-tuned understanding of how the correspondences of the world, of the modern mass-mediated world, work? Now, my tendency to my tendency here would be to say that, like, two things. One is that no, there, in fact, no one really is in control of these resonances. But on the other hand, all these professions, like marketing and like, you know, political propaganda and all the sort of the professions of modern mass publicity, in a way are premised on, in some sense, making us think that they know how to do that, right? So it's a weird sort of situation where you have a certain kind of professional claim about being able to control resonance, right? Okay, what is an advertising campaign if not a kind of wager on being able to set off certain kinds of resonances between certain kinds of people, a certain target market, and certain kinds of images or products? You know, what is a political campaign if not a wager on being able to trigger certain kinds of resonances of identification, of excitement, of desire between a particular political candidate and a particular, you know, target segment of the electorate, right? So there is this idea, and I think, you know, so many of the professions in contemporary mass publicity sort of in a way have to sell themselves on the premise that they know how to do this, but in fact, I think even they themselves know that no one is really in control of this process, and that once you put something out there in the world, whether it's, you know, Donald Trump or it's the latest ad for, you know, Coke or whatever brand, once you put it out there in the world, it's kind of unpredictable what kind of resonances it'll trigger. So you're always playing this kind of catch-up game to make sense of the resonances that emerge once these things are circulating out there in the world.
You know, it's funny. I want to emphasize one side of your point because, I'm very interested in conspiracy theory, and that's been part of my, you know, kind of set of researches for a long time. And there's a real irony there that you help clarify, which is that often you find that the people who are most invested in a particular kind of conspiratorial idea, let's say about mass mind control through the media, or, you know, the Masonic control of hip hop and R&B as a way to, you know, create certain effects in the populace, et cetera, is that those individuals in many ways mirror precisely the professional caste that is producing those things in the first place. So it's this weird loop where, like, the people who are distrusted are the ones who are also fomenting this idea that they're in control. So it's like there's a kind of, you know, a sort of football of control that's passed back and forth. But if you try to actually grab it, it's not there, at least from the kind of perspective you're coming from. But to my mind, it also still suggests that we do need to pay attention to these arts in a way, because they do illuminate better than anything else one aspect of how the modern world is constituted. And another way of thinking about that politically is that if you decide, let's say, to understand more about the intelligence world, and you want to understand exactly how intelligence fits in with the modern media, with the mainstream stories we tell, what things are being decided upon, what things aren't being decided upon. It's very difficult to go very far into that world without magical type things starting to seem more available, without your own worldview starting to kind of unravel and unhinge in certain ways, which is why conspiracy theory is such an attractive place, because once you start going certain directions, in a way your own thinking becomes more magical, and that's what happens to a lot of people, even very hard-headed people who try to go beneath the surface of a lot of the contemporary world, particularly if you talk about counterintelligence and misinformation and disinformation and how the intelligence agencies are kind of these labyrinths of mirrors. I mean, they get very weird, even if you're approaching them from a very hard-headed historical point of view. So for me, that really emphasizes why the kind of studies that you're doing, you know, are so important, that we do really need to think about this magical terms. But because we're talking about propaganda and politics, That sort of it raises an interesting question about the Trump phenomenon, because in a weird way, the Trump campaign almost kind of works by not seeming to be controlled by master manipulators. And it's sort of a – now, I don't know whether that's just being kind of like a meta move, like that the brilliant engineering of the Trump phenomena is that it doesn't look like it's brilliantly engineered by the same old political hacks. And yet at the same time, the demagoguery of the Trump phenomena, the visceral quote-unquote charisma that he produces for so many people is so visible. It's so obvious to – you know, those of us on the left who are not who don't resonate with the messages, but we can see the phenomena of resonance as this quote unquote irrational kind of thing more visibly than with Bush or Reagan or earlier kind of conservative figures to speak from a progressive left kind of angle. So there's something really interesting about what's going on with him. And I'd love to hear how you see that campaign and that sort of field of charisma.
I think, you know, we were talking a little while ago about this thing about how, you know, we like to attribute a kind of manipulative intent to mass publicity, and that somehow that makes us feel better because then we feel we can also kind of resist it. If someone's trying to manipulate us, we can resist it. One of the and that kind of makes us feel better about being self-determining kind of agents of individuals as well. So one of the things about that's really kind of remarkable about the whole Trump phenomenon, right, is that we are asking precisely the kinds of questions that you were just asking, which is like, is this like the inability to tell the difference between something that could be just on the one hand a kind of stumbling through, like not knowing where it's going, making it up on the fly, or maybe like this diabolically clever meta plan, which is meant to make us think that that's what's happening, right? That's what's so crazy about this phenomenon, right, is that from a kind of critical vantage point, like all the sort of the normal critical positions that one might occupy sort of from a left perspective or from a kind of conspiratorial ideology critique perspective become really hard to pass because it's never quite clear whether it's serious, whether it's satirical, whether it's incredibly smart, or whether it's just incredibly dumb. Those things kind of start floating into each other in a really disturbing way. And I think, you know, even from the beginning, I think, you know, I'll just speak for myself, you know, as someone who finds, you know, Trump and everything he stands for, like, utterly, utterly repulsive. Even at the beginning of that whole process, the first few Republican debates, when Trump was one among how many were they, 12 or something? There was this way in which even I was kind of fascinated just by watching him. Like, I tuned in to watch those debates, to watch Trump, basically. And I think that's really key to understanding the power of the Trump phenomenon, is that it really is, in some sense, operating beyond ideology. Of course, you know, the campaign has mobilized all kinds of, ideological positions and so forth. But the root of it really does seem to have to do with something other than something that we would conventionally recognize as a political platform. There's a kind of resonance going on there that has to do with something more basic, more fundamental, you know, who knows, maybe more transcendent or maybe more imminent, you know, than conventional political candidates. And that, I think, brings to light, again, the importance of thinking about these dynamics, not just in relation to Trump, but in relation to, you know, that part of our public life, which we would normally analyze in much more, quote unquote, rational ways.
Yeah, it raises a really interesting point. As one becomes aware that we are not just rational, but also resonating, to put it kind of a little bit simply, and that that's true of our own positions, of our own, affirmations, whether it's for a political position or for a pair of jeans or for a person or a novel or a film, whatever. There's a strange kind of instability that happens when we think about it in terms of ourselves or the people we live our lives with intimately, where on the one hand, it like creates this like, oh my God, I'm more duped than I think I was. And on the other hand, you're like, well, but that's just part of the way we are. So how, it's almost like, how do you bring a little bit of reason into the fact that you're also always resonating, whether it's politics or whatever? And it's a really interesting problem, because it's really, I mean, I think in that way, these issues, or this way of talking about these issues, gets to something very fundamental about ourselves, you know, individually or as individuals, psychologically, precisely in terms of the way in which we are not individuals. But we're really close to it when we start to think about how we are resonating and how we maybe even make arguments or reasons for things that are essentially just forms of resonance that come for whatever reason based on our past or whatever. So how to kind of live in that space between resonance and rationality.
Yeah, I mean, I think I tend to think of it as a kind of dialectical relationship. That is to say, yeah, at the root of it is kind of like resonant encounters, you know, between people and things, between things and things. And then we tell stories or we interpret those resonant encounters, sometimes in ways that are intended to kind of shore up our sense of self-determination or our sense of integrity, you know, sometimes in ways that are, you know, romantic stories about, oh, you know, we were fated to be together, or this is like the perfect product for me, or, you know, whatever. But those stories themselves then generate new resonances, right? So that there's a way in which, like, it's not as if we're operating on like two channels that are separate from each other. There's not like the irrational resonance channel and then the kind of rational narrative channel or an analytical channel, but those things are like constantly feeding off each other. So the resonance produces like analysis and interpretation, but those like the rhetoric and the narratives that come out of those interpretations in turn produce new kind of resonant encounters. So it goes back and forth like that. And, you know, and I do think that a lot of what we do in social life is a kind of retroactive making sense of things that are happening in a way out of our control, but sometimes only with like a half second time lag. You know, there's all this stuff about how our kind of nervous system responds or like acts before we know we're deliberately acting. And I think that in a way it's a good analogy for the way that so much of, you know, what we do happens in the world, which is that it kind of happens at the level of a kind of unconscious resonance, which we then make sense of. But then in making sense of it, we produce new conditions for resonance.
Yeah, there's a great line in your paper that turns on this retroactive thing, which I think is so key. And once you start thinking about it, it opens up so many very interesting and some very interesting esoteric zones. But you write, that is why, whether the encounter involves an intimate partner, a political leader, a spiritual illumination, or perhaps simply the perfect pair of jeans, we can experience an unprecedented situation of just what I always wanted, even though we did not know we wanted it until that moment, and by the very same token, experience our new feeling of ourselves as who I really was all along, even though this is the first time we encounter ourselves in this light. And we all know this feeling. It's a very strange event where you suddenly kind of see yourself shift in a way where what you shift into gains the substance of who you really are almost instantaneously. And, you know, and in a way that's where you can't expect to get out of that loop, either through hyper analysis or through absolute immersion in resonance. You know, there's no way out of that kind of process, although clearly the way we think about it and the way we nurture or manage our resonances makes a difference in terms of how things unfold.
That's right. And you know, that would be one of the names, you know, one of the phenomena for which I feel like the term mana is kind of useful, right, is for the power of those kind of encounters, where you feel like, you know, for the first time, I am who I always was, right? That kind of moment of the encounter with the decisive, you know, of course, it might fade like the next day, you know, or the next hour, you realize, no, that wasn't it, right? And more often than not, it's like, you know, those things don't last. But there are those moments of illumination or those moments of kind of activation where you feel like something really profound is happening here. And again, as you said, you know, it could be happening at a secular level. It could be happening at a spiritual level. It could be happening at, you know, an ideological level or whatever. But those moments where something comes into focus, which feels both utterly new and in a way as if, you know, that was what you were all along, and that was what you had been looking for all along, and that was, you know, who you had been all along, you know, that kind of mysterious doubling.
Yeah, and I think that that happens with music a lot. I mean, we just have a couple of minutes here, so I don't want to open the door. I did want to tip my hat to the fact that most of the time that we've talked, we talk about music, and in a way that for me, this whole conversation has that kind of going on in the background. That moment, that illumination, which really shifts the whole field and yet somehow seems absolutely intimate as if it was always there, is an experience I often have, with music. And, you know, I'm sure you do as well. I just wanted to, with the last couple of minutes, since we can't really go into that, are you already done with this book? Are you working on how are you going to elaborate some of this stuff in the book you're doing on this?
So the book is almost done. It's going to be done in the next few weeks. And then, you know, as I mentioned, it will come out next year. And I think my next big project is something that I've been working on for a long time, actually. And it takes me back to India, but also advertising. And it's a way of telling a real life or a real world story that involves all of these themes that we've been talking about, you know, the kind of the mana of mass publicity. And it's about this this man who in the late 60s and early 70s was kind of like the charismatic, the most flamboyant, charismatic kind of madman, if you like, of Bombay, of his generation, and who had this agency that existed, an advertising agency that existed for only 10 years, which went from almost nothing to being like one of the top three, and then crashed in this sort of hailstorm of bad debts and spectacular financial mismanagement within 10 years. But this man that I'm interested in telling the story of, his name was Kersi Katrak. He was not only an ad person, but actually saw himself as a little bit of a magician in the sense that he was also a devotee of Gurdjieff. He was a poet. So he sort of combined in his own life and in his own practice kind of the arts of mass publicity with the occult arts and with the literary arts in a way that I find really fascinating and that I think could be used to really unpack some of these ideas that I've been approaching at a kind of theoretical level in this book that I'm working on now.
Great. Well, we'll have to end it there. That sounds wonderful. I'm glad you're going to be doing that project, and I look forward to both books when they come out. So, William Mazzarella, thanks so much for joining us and Expanding Mind.
It's been great. Thanks, Eric.
All right, folks. Next week, we're going to talk to Jesse Jarno about Heads, A History of Psychedelic America. Until then, keep your minds open.